I believe where we ended the last tape was where I talked about John Andrews approving a model, a facelift of our so-called P3, the first all-new vehicle over there, and then canceling out that program and coming with a replacement, an all-new vehicle. And this was a very intriguing way of doing business, and one that he was very capable of doing, because he had tremendous success, and therefore he had a lot of influence, and he was able to see the market and determine that this was the best way to go, and he was able to influence the people to do so. Anyway, we developed what was then called the P5, which is this model. My going away present from Germany was the a coupe version of this so-called P5.
How did it differ from the earlier, the one that was scrapped?
Well, from a point of view of styling, it was, as they used to refer to, the cube was filled out. It had a little bit longer wheelbase, I think maybe 3.5 or so inches longer wheelbase. So it had more interior room from point of view of like leg room. The width was similar, it was maybe slightly wider. It was designed, however, for an all-new engine. In addition to the four-cylinder engine which they had, they developed a V6. So this came out in production with two engines, a V6 and a 4.
What year was this again?
It came into production in 1965, I believe, 64. I think it was 65. I'm not positive. It may have been the 64 as a 65 model, yes. And we did many wind tunnel studies on this and tried many different designs, and one which John Andrews was very interested in, which was more, had the appearance of a more streamlined car, but showed no gain in aerodynamics, and was not liked as well as this design, which was more an evolution of the earlier model. And so it came out with a drag factor very similar or slightly less, slightly lower than the other car, yet was a little bit larger, or as I said, had the cube filled out. But we had an
cube is you're referring to the
filling out the size of the car rather than the extreme form shapes that we had before, very much tucked in front and very much of an oval shape from side view. This had more of a straight line side, not really straight, but straightened up, let's say, to some extent. However, since we had opportunities to test it in the wind tunnel, we did such things as reducing the offset of side glass to the pillars, and we found considerable gain there. Came up with a different rain gutter drip molding, which proved to be quite useful in reducing the drag, and various other things which worked quite well, and these were all incorporated. So it came into production at a very good drag factor in those days. It was like 0.395, something like this, and with the coupe version being better than that, maybe 0.38. But so that came out, and of course, this Cardinal had come out the meantime. And then they decided they wanted to do a facelift on the Cardinal. And so there was more and more involvement by people here in the States as time went on.
Cardinal was a code name, was it not?
It was a code name. It was a front-wheel drive vehicle that was designed here, but it was a very poor design, and it was decided by American management that it should be produced both in Germany and here, and then it was further decided that they would not produce it here. So it was left for production only in Germany, and it was not designed for the German market, and therefore did not fit the German market well. But it was developed and produced, and an interesting story, a side story, which I may as well put in here.
Yeah.
After we had returned from Germany, and during a period of time when Andrews was, and I don't know that I've told this before or not on this tape, during the period of time that he was on medical retirement due to his leukemia, we would have these parties such as we had had in Germany. All of these people that had been together over there would get together occasionally over here. And the last time that I saw him, I believe, he told some of these stories. One of these was, I believe it was Kuchar president of the company for a while?
Vice president. Executive vice president for research and design.
Well, then it's somebody else. I was going to look that up. The president of the company, whoever it was at that time, who had been a manufacturing man. It would have been
Extra.
Well, I'm getting two stories mixed up, but this one's interesting too. It was Dijkstra, I believe.
Yeah.
Dijkstra came over when this P5 was being developed, and one of the things that we didn't like about it was it had, I think, the same tread width. In other words, the wheel positions relative to the exterior of the car appeared too narrow on this car because we had filled the shape out, and it might have been slightly wider. I don't recall anymore. It could have been slightly wider. So the wheels looked as if they stood too far in.
Mm-hmm.
And he did two things. He suggested that we should increase the tread width and we should put on larger tires. And immediately our director of engineering picked this up, Goodsight, who was from the States, but he was a German.
Mm.
And he was a very good, understanding fellow. You could talk with him and reason with him, and this is not true with many engineers. Mm. Many engineers would have taken this as a criticism, and they would have knocked it down and not accepted, but he saw the advantages. So one of the last things, not too long before I went into production, like, I don't know, 3-4 months, this change was made. The tread was increased, front and rear, and they went to the next size tire, which was the tire that was going to be used on the station wagon anyway. And this gave this car the stance on the road that gave it the appearance of a Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, yes.
And when it came out and you saw the thing on the road, it had the appearance of being a very stable car and made a tremendous difference. Well, one of the stories that John Andrews told that night was about Dijkstra. And it was this trip. And he went with him, this John Andrews went with Dijkstra to some of the other Ford installations in Europe. He ended up by going to with him to Italy and looked at their sales places and I suppose other things too. And Dexter was supposed to leave on a certain plane, and I'm not sure where it was from. It may have been from Rome. And so they went to the airport, and for some reason or other, he wasn't getting cleared. And I don't know what the reason was.
Through customs?
Through customs. Mm-hmm. They ran out of time or something. Uh-huh. The plane was going to leave, and he was going to miss this plane, and John took this as a personal, could have been a personal offense to him from Dykstra. And he grabbed his luggage and grabbed him and ran him out to the airplane and put him on with his luggage and turned around to the Italian authorities and said, "I'll take responsibility." And, you know, they could have arrested him and locked him up.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, he did all the explaining and got himself out of it. I guess he had to pay some sort of a fine. Well, the other story he told was very interesting because this cardinal program, as I had talked before, was something that was forced on to Germany. And it was a design that they didn't want. We had a perfect design which we knew would sell and which was proven would sell because Opel came out with the Cadet shortly after that, which was the size and type of vehicle that we would have had. And it sold like three times the numbers that the Cardinal did. But anyway, when the decision was made that it was going to be a Ford of Germany car only, Henry Ford asked John Andrews if he would was satisfied with the program, that if he wished he didn't have to take it, he could go back and redesign or design his own vehicle. Mm-hmm. And John Andrews said no. He says, "We'll go ahead with this." Now, maybe I mentioned this before, but this was a story that John told that night after he had been retired due to this leukemia. And it's the first time that any of those people heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Had any treatment.
But
might have been something else.
It might have been something else, but of course it would have taken a couple more years perhaps. Mm-hmm. And he was anxious, eager to get it out in production. Well, anyway, so we did the P5. And then they wanted to do a facelift on the Cardinal. And so we started getting models that had been developed over in Dearborn here. And they would make a cast and send them over. So we had a final show. We had models, and there were models there that had been made in Dearborn. And they chose a design that had been made in Dearborn. And so we didn't have an opportunity to run that one through the wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. And so we had to go through, since a model already existed, we had to take templates and points off of it, and a surface layout drawing was made, and we made the final model surface. So before we released it, I said, "We've got to do a wind tunnel study on this because there's some things about it that really bother me." And so we did. We made a through this system that I had helped develop. I've got it, I think, here someplace. Maybe it's in that book. Arrow. It's in this this paper that is called Aerodynamic Tuning at Ford of Germany. And so we made the 1-5 model and took the wind tunnel. And the original design as this was developed here in the States and as it was interpreted over there had a drag factor of 0.445, which was considerably higher than, like 10% higher than our other car. And it had a quite a high lift on the front axle, which is something you don't want on a front-wheel drive car. And so we made changes in the wind tunnel by changing the hood and changing the apron or skirt underneath the hood, underneath the bumper, pardon me. And on this scale model, we were able to correct the problem. And I've got photographs of that. And you can see the difficulties here.
Can you explain it in audio
terms? Yes. As the air would come over the hood, the complete hood was disturbed. Mm-hmm. And by putting on these tufts of wool, you can watch the airflow. Mm. And as you can see from this photograph, this whole area was disturbed, which caused two things. It increased drag and it increased lift.
This is the area between the windscreen and the
It, front it was the due to the shape right at the front edge of the hood.
Oh, okay.
The changes were made to this model in the wind tunnel, and this is the way that the air flowed over the hood after the changes were made.
What changes were they?
Well, basically, it was changing the shape of the front edge of the hood.
Uh-huh.
It had a sharp chamfered edge, perhaps a 2-inch area above the grill, and then a sharp edge going back over the hood surface. And this caused the disturbance of the air. Basically, what we did was to lay that back about an additional 20 degrees and kept the 2 inches, but laying it back, it swung down perhaps by 1 inch, and then blending that into the hood surface at the back. So the design character was not changed, except it was softened.
Mm-hmm.
And that made the difference, as you can see, between this picture and this picture. This was a final full-size photograph of the prototype in the wind tunnel. Of course, it had those improvements also.
Mm-hmm.
The other change that was made was filling out and extending the skirt underneath the bumper.
Had there been a problem in the wind tunnel with that as well?
Well, that likewise reduced the drag and reduced the lift.
Okay.
And the final figure on that was a drag coefficient of 0.364.
Mm.
So that came down from 44.445 to 0.364, which is quite a dramatic change.
Drastic. All due to the adjusting of the front end.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The to give a further example of what this improvement would do,
mm-hmm.
The original design, if we consider that as the top speed of that as 100%, and the fuel consumption at 75 miles an hour as being 100%, and the reserve of power above that as a figure of 100%, the modifications into the production vehicle, the top speed was increased to 107.3. In other words, the top speed was increased by 7.3%. The fuel consumption was reduced to 87%, or a reduction of 13%. And the reserve of power, likewise, was increased by 16.2%. The coupe version was even considerably better than that. But anyway, that
those
gives...
Those are incredible figures for that period there.
Well, it was possible because of the system we had developed to go to the wind tunnel while you still had the model in a development stage where you could do something. So we came back with these figures and showed what the problem was, and of course we were given an approval to go ahead with them. So we made the changes and then of course went down to the wind tunnel after the changes and proved them out, and likewise went to the wind tunnel with the first prototype vehicles.
This is a very fairly early for aerodynamics to come into Ford styling, is it not? Even in
yes, the system was developed actually in 59 and 60 and became more sophisticated as time went on, so that eventually the models had full pressure point tests, had open engine compartments, and a representative radiator, and so it was very near as we could get it to a production vehicle. So anyway, the Breedlot was again in an American design, although it
was that, what'd you call it again?
They call that program the Prelot.
How do you spell that?
Well, Prelot is maybe it says, I don't know, that's an article. A Prelot is a also a person in the Catholic hierarchy, I believe.
Right. Prelate, I guess.
Prelate. Auf Deutsch, we call it Prelat.
Prelat, yes, right. Okay, Prelat.
All right.
In English, probably not in German. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good, okay.
The cardinal was not the bird, it was, again.
Again, another part of the. Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't realized that.
It was a Catholic.
Prelat.
Yes.
Prelat,
so.
I wonder why those names were chosen.
I don't know. I don't.
Was one of the executives a Catholic?
I don't know. I really never heard, except that, of course, when they came with the facelift, it was understandable why they called the facelift the Prelat.
Had anyone ever thought of naming a car after Martin Luther in Germany?
I've never heard of Luther.
It's not.
Never heard of a Luther. It's usually the person's name that did the development, you know.
Right.
or something that pertains to something very economical. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a few of those. So then the next thing that happened was that we did a facelift. We went through this facelift bit again. They wanted to do a facelift on the P5, and we did a development that had some rather interesting things on it, particularly the front end and grill, and it seemed to grow a little bit more in appearance. So we had a problem getting the drag factor down or holding it. So actually it ended up with a slightly higher drag factor, but no one in design liked this. But what had happened in the meantime in management was that Gutzeit, the director of engineering, had retired, and he was replaced. I wish I could get these names.
How do you spell his name?
Gutseit. Gutseit. Mm-hmm. Jules Gutseit. I'm going to turn it off. Let me see if I can get these names. We had an American engineer, in fact, two of them come over. J.L. Hooven.
H-O-O-V-E-N,
and F.W. Bloom, Fred Bloom, Jack Hooven and Fred Bloom, B-L-O-O-M. And so they started organizing the engineering operation on American standards. And we had been working as really as a German company, and the engineering was strictly from German standards, German understanding of engineering, which was different. And so they were in the process of changing some of these things, and it was not very well accepted. Well, design came under Hooven also. And Hooven was rather a ruthless person and very little understanding. And Dahlberg didn't get along with him at all. And he didn't understand Dahlberg, and Dahlberg didn't like the man. And
had he been sent over by Dearborn to revise engineering practices?
Yes.
For what reason? Why did Dearborn think that had to be done?
Well, by that time, of course, Andrews had come back and had been the beginning of Ford of Europe. Well, John Andrews came back and became first, president, or I think, what do they call him, vice president or president of Ford?
Of Europe?
Well, now, this was before that. At first, he was put in of European operations, whatever they called that at that time. And then they established, but the intent, I'm sure, was to establish this Ford of Europe. So they established Ford of Europe, and he became president and chairman of the board of Ford of Europe when it was first established. And it was during that period of time that they found he had leukemia, and he had to accept an early retirement because of that. But anyway, so Andrews was not there, and it was like dropping the pilot, because he was the man that had built Ford of Europe and understood it and understood the people. The people understood him, and it was a completely different situation. His assistant director, or I guess it was general manager, was I'll turn off a minute until I can. When Andrews left, Robert G. Layton was the assistant general manager. So he was made general manager, and he was a German, although he had been in the States and worked for Ford. Was, I believe, background was finance, and so he was made general manager, and while he knew finance, he was sort of lost in the areas of design and engineering. And when Hooven came over, he relied heavily on Hooven, and the decision to send Hooven over was, I think, partially to move him out of areas of engineering where he was causing too many difficulties. Hmm. And
they have an abrasive personality?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
And since they had an opening for someone there, why they sent him there. I think Fred Bloom is probably his, more or less, his protege, sidekick, something, you know. Mm-hmm. And Fred Bloom was a pretty good guy, but he usually tried to stick to the book too much, and was therefore the interest that existed in trying to develop something new and different sort of went away. Mm-hmm. And things became sort of
routine
and uninteresting, and the programs sort of lacked the sparkle that they had had before. So we were working on this facelift of the P5 to be called the P7, and it took a year longer than they had planned. And each step of the way, as they would make a decision, the design was suffered because of either engineering or manufacturing reasons. And the vehicle actually didn't come out until after we left. It came out in the fall of 1967, and at that time Opel Rekord had come out, I think, a year before with a new car, or a major facelift that it could have been a major facelift of their previous car, but they came out a year ahead of the Taunus, and therefore the Taunus was sort of out of step, and it had been so the design, so...
Excuse me, how do you spell Rekord?
R-E-C-O-R-D.
That is?
The Opel.
Was that the name of the...
That's General Motors.
Yes, was that the name of the vehicle, Rekord?
Yes. That was the vehicle that was on the same level, same class size as the Taunus 17M, 20M. 20M was the V6 engine, and then the 17M was the 4.
And they came out a year ahead of
them. They came out a year ahead, and sometime, it must have, it was before, certainly before I left, it may have been in June or July of 1967, probably in June, one time that Leighton was over, and he asked me to come out, and I went out and sat in his car before he left, and he was obviously at that point in time concerned about the design, and he asked me my opinion, and of course I wasn't able to aid his concern, because I said, well, it's just too little too late, it's a year late, and what has been done is just not an interesting design anymore. And this proved to be the situation when it came into production. People didn't like it, and it didn't fit the market right, and so they scrambled and made a facelift on the facelift a year later. But what had happened early in 67 was rather destabilizing. Hooven, his dislike for Dahlberg and the way Dahlberg worked, wrote a performance review giving Dahlberg an unsatisfactory. And sent it through, of course, it went through to Bordenay, where it went through, and Bordenay was contacted. And Bordenay jumped up and down and immediately took a plane over. And thought it was very unfair, and...
Bordenay thought it was?
Yes.
Yeah. Had Bordenay been consulted on the Hooven appointment?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But Bordenay, by that time, of course, the involvement of the people from the U.S. was quite full. Any time we would have a major presentation, why, Bordenay would be there. And also Bob McGuire. Bob McGuire was responsible at that point in time for our operation from a dotted line responsibility. So Bob McGuire would make many trips over. And since I had worked for him before, Wes and I had worked for him before going to Germany. It was a pleasant experience. I always liked Bob McGuire anyway, and he would come over and we would go to dinner, and he was always had to be the center of attention, and one thing, a minor thing I'll tell you about, it's interesting. He would always have a special dessert, and he would have a dish of vanilla ice cream, and on that a small amount of cognac, and then coffee grounds. Ground coffee, not coffee grounds,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
Fresh,
right.
Ground fresh coffee bread. Sprinkled on that. It was very good. You know, something quite different. But he'd go into these German or English. He also did an English restaurant when we were there one time. And this was, you know, it always stirred things up. And that's the way he was. We did do a combined program with Ford of England, and that was when Duncan McRae was in England, and we did some developments in Germany, and they had done some in England. It was decided that it was going to be an English vehicle, and they wanted to develop their cars, but they wanted input from Germany, and so we had German designers and modelers stationed in England for a period of about 6 months, and we would change these like every 2 weeks. So I was over there for a period of off and on for about 6 months, running that operation as well as the one back in Cologne. Well, anyway, we completed the stint in Germany, and
what was the upshot of the Hooven up there?
Well, Bornier came over, and what they did, they relieved Dahlberg of that responsibility, and he went back, came back to Dearborn, and was put in as an executive designer in, I think at first in interiors, yes, he was in interiors, and this was under, of course, under Bob McGuire, so he had protection at that time. Since Duncan McRae was in England, they sent Duncan McRae to Germany. So the last 6 months that I was in Germany was under Duncan McRae. And this was at the time when they were establishing Ford of Europe. And Damon Woods was sent over as Vice President Design Ford of Europe. And since I had been doing these manpower developments for budget purposes, they asked me if I would aid them in some various studies. So the last 6 months, most of the work, or a lot of the work that I did, was developing various proposals of how they might split the work between Germany and England.
Uh-huh.
They didn't want to shut down either one of the two operations, the design operations. So eventually what evolved, of course, was that they do the passenger car developments in Germany, and they do the truck and the interiors in Germany, in England.
They
coordinate these. There's much back and forth movement of people to at least direct the work.
Actually, a shuttle, I
understand. Yes. Well, when I was preparing to leave, I realized that something was going on. I didn't know what, but of course I had modeling and fabrication, and I didn't do a lot of investigating, but my last day, they had this party in an area that is reserved for sales promotions and so forth at Ford, Ford Werke, their own areas. And so they had all the people from the design there, and they presented this model to me, which of course you've seen. Mm-hmm. It's a one-off replication of the Taunus, the P5 Taunus, and represented the coupe that I was driving at the time. And it's a red coupe, of course, and had my license plate number and the American flag hanging from the rearview mirror, which inside, which I always had on my car. It has all the interior appointments and exterior sheet metal items such as bumpers and grills were made from actual production pieces rather than from a drawing by an exceptional metal craftsman who set these up and took his own points and layouts and made the forms. They're hammered out of copper and chrome plated, so it's quite an unusual model in these respects. Everybody worked on it, but all the modelers and all the fabrication people. They made a separate half cast of this, which was a signature cast, which they all signed. And so it's something that I believe someday should go to Ford Archives. But the stay in Germany, by that time we had been there 9 years, and so it really was home. The family was accustomed to Europe, not just Germany. My daughter had gone to a high school in Switzerland when she was 15, a Swiss school in Montreux, right on Lake Geneva. And after graduating from high school, went to Cleveland Institute of Art. So her mother came back with her for that to get her adjusted. Our older son went 1 year at an English school that is in Switzerland, by an exceptional school. And so for a 4 year period we were quite familiar with particularly one area of Switzerland, in Montreux, and that area, as well as Germany, as we had many trips in Germany. So Europe, or in Germany and Europe, Europe became, really came quite familiar with us. And it was as great an adjustment coming back here as it was going there. And of course, during that time, we came back in August of 67. The liberal movement had taken charge, and things were so different than when we had left in 58. And this was hard to become accustomed to. And really, we didn't. we always took a ship on our family trips back and forth. When I would come back on business, I'd fly or go over. But so we did travel on several trips, including the United States, Queen Elizabeth, Rotterdam, France, the Constitution, and a smaller one-class ship called the Atlantic. Well, these were all very interesting, and many times we took our trips through the Mediterranean and stopped at different ports. So
you mentioned the Mediterranean.
Well, we left from Geneva and disembarked at Geneva a couple of times. We left at Naples once. Of course, the various parts were those two cities, of course, plus Sardinia and Gibraltar. I think we were in Gibraltar like 3 times. Cannes, we were at Cannes several times from the ship, as well as driving through Casablanca, Lisbon, Barcelona. These were all from the ship, you know. This
yes.
Be very, very interesting. Madeira.
Lovely wine from that area.
Yes. It's an interesting place. Very, very unusual. It's So anyway, we...
You felt after your long surgery and you deserved a bit of a sightseeing trip.
Well, we had... It was our vacation.
Of course.
And the trip was... The home leave was paid for. I couldn't see any reason to fly back. And the family wasn't particularly interested in flying anyway. And the ships... I always enjoyed ships. And the opportunity to visit these ports is something that otherwise you'd never have. And of course, this was sort of the real outside of the pre-war days, the 30s and 20s, and I suppose the period before the First World War. The 50s and 60s were the real heyday of the ocean liners. The cross-ocean flights were coming in, but it was really not until the latter part of the 60s and the 70s that it took over from the ships, and the ships sort of disappeared. So it was a real interesting time. Well, we came back, and it's always a disturbing time, because when you've been on an overseas assignment, you don't know whether, when you come back, whether you're going to have a job or not, or what the job will be. And before we came back, they had instituted, I think, International Division under the effort and guidance and complaint of John Andrews, made a really great effort to see that people who had been important in operations overseas would not be just dropped off somehow.
Right.
And so I came back, and initially I was put in as assistant manager of interior modeling. And of course, this was under Bob McGuire. And the manager at that time was Leonard Stobar.
Oh, yeah.
And this was from August until January, and Stobar had a lot of problems, health problems, and he had an alcohol problem, had had an alcohol problem many years, and it had, of course, affected his health. So he retired in January, and I was made manager of interiors. Well, some of the things that were happening, and these things I want to talk about, are very important and critical to the operation of the design center, and particularly the functions of modeling and the ability of model development to be capable of the work that was coming, particularly the numerical work. I had been working in Europe developing and planning systems that would be able to accommodate electronic scanning and milling. And these included a positioning system for the models and methods of handling the models. And not only exterior, but I had started the development of instrument panels. And had built some at that time, some rather preliminary and methods of handling the instrument panel, but they were important for the developments that came later in Dearborn. We'd also developed in a new design center, which design moved into in the fall of 67. All new equipment. We had developed a new bridge that was very exact and was powered and had a readout, at least for the x-axis. And so it was possible with that bridge to be able to very accurately develop models, which was, of course, very important for any scanning that you're going to do. And in January of 67, I had taken a clay model of an instrument panel to turn And with the aid of the operator in Turin, the chief engineer, actually, to point-to-point scan and point-to-point mill points back into the clay model. So the first scan mill operation on a clay model was done in January of 67 in this clay model that I had taken to D in Turin. So when I came back, of course, they had established a numerical systems operation and design center. And
this was in
67. And they had developed a machine which was a highly modified portage layout machine. Body engineering had had this and had attempted to do some developments. And Design Center had bought this from them, and Manufacturing Engineering Office had aided them in further developing a point-to-point scanning system. And this proved to be, outside of DIA's developments, probably the first development for scanning. And that went into operation during 1967.
And,
well, I have a picture, yes, if you want to turn that off.
Yeah.
It's based on a portage layout machine. Portage layout machine has been used for years and years. I don't know exactly when it was developed. I suppose either during or following World War II. And basically, it has a steel base, which has rollers built into it. And they have a system of special plates that have grooves machined into it, so that these rollers roll in the grooves and against an edge. And so you, the rollers are bearings, so that you have the machine base always in an orthogonal position. That is, always in one position relative to the rail, and it will roll easily and can be locked in place. The columns are aluminum castings that have been machined, and basically have three sides, and on those three sides they have again rollers or bearings that are attached to a housing that will permit the housing to slide up and down the column. The housing has has machined areas that supports a second column, a smaller column that travels in and out. And again, this column rides on bearings or rollers and permits it to roll quite easily. Now, you can lock all of these in position. The housing and the horizontal arm or column is counterbalanced, so you can easily move it up or down. On the end of the column, I do have something to show you here, is a universal head that holds a point probe. It's a contact probe.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make contact with the clay, it will record that particular point. It records the position of the three axes. In other words, when you're going to use this on a model, you would come to a point or location on the model that is known. In other words, if you have certain bases or surfaces or lines that are scribed on the model, for instance, you can bring the model bring the scanner to those positions and mark in on your readout what those are. You put them in and you start working from that. So that would be, in other words, if you've got a height of 20 inches or 40 millimeters, let's say, you'd use that as your Y position. And if you have a reference of fore and aft of 100 millimeters or whatever, you put that in as your X reference. Mm-hmm. And if you have a position of whatever, 80 millimeters out from center line, you would noodle in on this and record this as your position for the Z measurement. Mm-hmm. And from that, from those three positions, then you start recording the information on the model. And they would all be related thereafter from those three positions. But this went into use in 1967, and it was called an interim scanner. And it was called interim scanner because it was planned that they were going to buy new equipment, so that it would only be used for a short time. So they did, Ford Design Center did order two machines from DIA, digital electronic automation from Turin, Italy.
Mm.
And
one of the leaders in the field at that time.
Yes, they had started a fellow by the name of Sartorio had developed this machine and this system back in, I think, in 1964. And had been shown at the tool show in Germany that year. And I know when I went to the Turin Auto Show that fall, I visited his plant, which was in Turin, and looked at it, and I followed their developments, and he was in design several times and design in Germany. And we were going through the process of trying to buy a machine there for use for design and engineering. So we did several developments, including this scanning and milling operation that I did in January '67. But so anyway, there had been a team of Americans that went to Europe and looked at the various things that were under development, including the DIA machine, and subsequently ordered a DIA Alpha large enough to handle a full-size vehicle, and it would have two heads working off of one gantry so that it could operate on either side of a vehicle. And also, they ordered a portable, and the portable was to be a very sophisticated unit. It was powered and could be guided through the hallways into a studio, so we could go to a model, whereas otherwise the model would have to go to the Alpha scanner. But it took a long time to build these units. The two-headed Alpha was something they had not done. They had built a large machine, so they did have the design for a large machine. But there was a lot of both mechanical and particularly software computer operations that had never been developed before for the type of scanning that they wanted to do at Ford. And it went into, I think, something like 3 years.
Development work.
3 and 4 years before they were ever delivered. And so the interim scanner, of course, kept being used and used. And I think these two machines were delivered maybe in 70, must have been 1970 perhaps, which is like at least 3 years later. And when you put in a machine, a system like that, it just doesn't go in and start operating. It takes time. And there's all sorts of things you have to learn about the machine and functions and systems for making it work and utilizing the data that you're getting. And then it takes time just to work out some of the bugs. So it always takes at least a year to get a machine in, up and running.
This was the beginning of CAD then.
Yeah, but it was slow. It took time. It took considerable time. The portable was always having problems, and always breaking down someplace, and not working right. And the Alpha would break down and would be out of operation for. You never know whether it's going to be down for 10 minutes or 10 hours or 10 days. And so it was a slow process. But eventually these machines started functioning.